They sent the hired men and troopers to wipe out the diggers' claim, tear down their cottages, destroy their corn. They were dispersed, but still the vision lingers on. You poor take courage, you rich take care. This earth was made a common treasury for everyone to share. All things in common, all people one. We come in peace, the orders came to cut them down.
Welcome to Radio Free Kanata. I'm your host, Kevin Annett. Welcome back. This is July the 5th. And welcome back to my co-host, Ryan Gable, who's feeling much better now. And you're listening on the BBS Radio Network. We're here every Sunday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, and 11 p.m. in merry old England. Hello and welcome to all of you loyal insomniacs in England. It's good to have you with us again. Now, today we're going to carry on from last week. If you recall, we had a wonderful woman and activist from Winnipeg named Debbie, who's leading the fight there to expose not just child trafficking, but the rampant abuse going on, personified by one fellow called Robert Campbell, who's a serving United Church minister, who has already been named as having been a dangerous threat to the children in that community, and yet there he is in the pulpit. And we're going to talk about that and other aspects of the so-called CFS, Child and Family Services, where it came from and how it is actually committing crime, actual crime against humanity under international law. We're going to get into that today. In the second half of the show, we're going to talk about what people can do as communities, not just as individuals, but as communities, to reclaim their children and the law. And the one of the mechanisms for that is the People's Assemblies, which are being put forward as a model for how people in the jurisdiction of Kanata can reclaim their country. So we're going to look at all of that today. And you can follow our work, kanatarepublic.ca. That's K-A-N-A-T-A for you folks who may not know the origin of the meaning. It means our village in the Haudenosaunee language. kanatarepublic.ca. And before we get into our regular show, I want to mention two things. First of all, a number of our local conveners and listeners have suggested that we devote some part of the show and at least one whole program every month to an educational component, that is, having actual mini lectures, say 15 or 20 minutes long, into aspects of the common law, the republic, the whole framework that we're trying to create. And so we are going to look at that in the coming months. We're going to definitely have more of an educational component on the show to feed that need for the understanding, the theory behind what we're doing. So thank you for that. We're going to be working on that. And if any of you have any suggestions and content you'd like to see in that aspect of the show, please write to us, republicofkanata@gmail.com. Now, I have promised you another little story from our hidden history in Canada, and this is a really relevant one. It has to do with why did the Indian residential school systems close in the first place? You know, Canada and the churches and everything like to pat themselves on the back for how suddenly humanitarian they become. But in fact, the schools did not close because of any humanitarian act on the part of the churches and government. Quite the contrary. They were literally forced to vacate the schools at gunpoint. For in July 1970, a group of Cree men and women took up arms and occupied the Blue Quills Catholic Indian School near Edmonton, one of the notorious schools where children had been dying at an alarming rate over the years. And the parents, in arms, demanded that the nuns and priests leave the premises. This Cree group of over 200 parents of children incarcerated in the school even took the local Indian agent hostage and told the Canadian government they'd never seen him alive again if the Catholic Church didn't leave the school immediately. Well, within a few days of frantic negotiating, Indian Affairs Minister Jean Chrétien, who, of course, went on to become Prime Minister, Chrétien gave in, and he ordered the Catholic Church to vacate Blue Quill School. The occupiers took over the school and began running it themselves, the first Indian school ever run by actual Indians in Canada. Over the following year, most of the Indian residential schools were then closed, or rather handed over to local Indian bands across Canada, although many of the abuses and harm continued against the children. One woman, and I actually met some of these folks when I was up in Edmonton a number of years ago, a woman who took part in the occupation was Margaret Quinney from Frog Lake. And she says, quote, "The very first thing we did was when we took over the school was we took down all the crosses and pews and we burned them in a big bonfire. We dismantled every sign of the white religion. This was our school now, and we could educate our own children about their real identity and make them proud of their heritage, unquote. And another fellow who I actually met, Stuart Steinhauer, who was a local Cree elder in that territory, said that the Blue Quills action proved that a community can fight off the government and win, but only when they all act together. We never get anything by asking. And that's, I think, a lesson we all need take to heart as we set out to not only fight genocide and ongoing war crimes in our own backyard, but how do we construct a new nation? So that was today's little slice of the history you didn't know about. And interestingly, just a PS on that, this last year, the state-run broadcasting corporation here in Kanata, the CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, has put out their own spin on the Blue Quills action. And guess what? They've watered it down so that there were no guns involved. Nobody was taken hostage. There wasn't even an occupation. There was a mild protest at the school, and then the Canadian government naturally responded in a very progressive way. Well, that's the rewrite of history, folks. But I know that I've been there. I've talked to the people who did it. We know better. So, Ryan, welcome again. Hope you're feeling better.
I am feeling better, Kevin. How are you doing?
Well, you know, I'm doing all right, I guess. We all have our health challenges, but it's good to have you back on.
Yeah, I'm glad to be back. I was interested to know when the natives took back over the residential schools, what was the yearly death rate? I'm sure that dropped probably substantially.
That's a good question. We don't have records of the death rates after I don't have any records after about 1969, and of course this happened the next year. We do know that as the 60s progressed and they began to close the schools during the 70s, the death rate did drop a little bit, although it wasn't uncommon to have a quarter of the kids dying. And again, that's an enormous amount. But you found that when the problem with estimating records, of course, is that the government by the early 60s had been doing a clean sweep of all the records, and they've admitted that. So, it actual figures are hard, but we do know that common sense says that when you've got this killing machine in operation, why is it going to change, right? How is it going to subside? And unless through actions like what the Cree folks did in Alberta.
Right, right. Do you have that information in any of your books that you've written?
You mean about the Blue Quills action?
Yes.
Yeah, that's actually, I talk a little bit about it at hiddennolonger.com. That's Hidden No Longer, Genocide in Canada, Past and Present. It's the third edition of my book that I first put out in 2001 with all of these testimonies.
I'm also very interested to know about the history of the CFS. I know a lot about the CPS here in America, but I'm interested to know how the CFS came about, what their kind of official policy is, and then what actually goes on behind the scenes. Maybe if we could get into that a little bit.
We are going to, and as a matter of fact, it's very related, because just before I bring on Debbie, I want to flag the fact that the Child and Family Services is, I didn't even realize this until I began to do some research. It exists in Manitoba, and it's racially targeted legislation. It's like the Indian Act. Today in the world, under international law, laws that are directed at one particular racial or cultural group are actually considered a crime. You're not supposed to set people apart like that in separate categories, and yet the CFS did. It was set up in 1988 I'm going to get into this, but it was basically an inquiry, an Aboriginal Justice Inquiry, it was called in Manitoba, chaired by, guess who, Murray Sinclair, who then went on to run this TRC farce that covered up genocide. The same guy set up this Aboriginal Justice Inquiry, and basically it recommended things along the line of what's called Agenda 21, which is, you know, outright. It's a way to get Native people off the government under the guise of turning it over to the local bands. They're basically disenfranchising and impoverishing Native families. But we're going to get into that, Ryan. I'm very glad you flagged that, because it's really central to what we're going to talk about with Debbie. Debbie, welcome again to the show.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
It's really great to have you back. I know that you've got a lot going on these days in the work you're doing, so thank you for being on the show. Do you want to give folks who may be new to the program and didn't listen last week a little bit of who you are and the work you've been doing?
Yeah, I'm an activist, advocate for the poor and for families that have been affected by CFS. And, of course, it branches out to poverty and so on and so on. And I basically just started out talking with families, hearing their side of the stories and how they've been impacted by CFS and just the torment and the hurt and all the horrible things that have happened to them. It's just disgraceful what's happening to these families. And like you said, Kevin, they are ripping families apart. They're not trying to keep them together. They're violating their own acts. You can follow on the Manitoba website what they're supposed to be doing and their care and concern for families, and they don't follow their own rules.
Now, let's to just backtrack a little bit. You did in the last program, you gave some pretty horrific accounts of things happening right now to families in the north end of Winnipeg. Do you want to describe a little bit about exactly what the police and CFS are doing to families on the ground?
Yes. Generally, if there's it all depends on which family you talk to. There are some members in the community that do have a capacity to speak up for themselves or try to defend themselves, whereas there's others that are in fear and silenced. So it's very hard to extract from the fear-based and the silence-based, but it takes time for them to get comfortable with you. But in one particular case that we talked about last week, this family was storm-trooped by the police, and they demanded to know where her son was, and he was he's a 16-year-old boy, and the mother was looking after six or seven children, and she didn't know where he was, and they returned approximately with 20 minutes in a 20-minute span. They came back and they knocked down their door. They were there with CFS. They apprehended all the children. They destroyed. It's almost like they took pleasure in destroying their home. And, you know, these are people that live in poverty, and they're picking up furniture that they find on the street and bringing it in and, you know, redoing it to make it look nice. And they destroyed all their property. This home, this house isn't even theirs. They're renting it.
These are the cops. Who did the actual destruction?
The police are actually, the Winnipeg police are actually calling CFS and escorting them to the house. So they may not have any interaction with CFS. In one case, there was a parent that got into a disagreement with a police officer and didn't agree with what the police officer had said. And she walked out, and by the time she got home, the police were there and they apprehended her children. And they accused her of being mentally unstable because she had a concern about the school. And, of course, this is where it all ties in. The people at the school, the teachers, and not to say that all teachers are like this or all schools are like this, but this is, I'm just relaying back to you what has been told to me. They don't come in with a warrant. We're trying to follow the law, but it seems to me like the law doesn't have to follow the law. You're supposed to have a warrant coming into this house. They didn't have a warrant, and that's a crime. Yep. But when you're a citizen, you're basically, if you call the police for an issue, they don't want to deal with it. They just send you to court. That's a civil matter. They're just constantly bouncing you around from one shadow group to another shadow group. And it ties in with this.
It sounds surprisingly like Vancouver, and having worked on the streets for many years in Vancouver, what you don't do is call the police on any matter, because they tend to check you out and target you. And if you're vulnerable at all, like if you're a mom on welfare, you will have your kids taken away, because the police roam around. They like search for children to traffic. That's clearly what's going on. Would you say that's a fair description of the Winnipeg police in these situations?
Yes, I think that it is a fair description, but it's also very under the radar.
Yeah.
And they're a little more quiet here in Winnipeg. And I think it takes people like myself to actually stand up. And there was a fellow, Jules Gray Eyes, that he was a big advocate in Winnipeg here. He helped a lot of families. and they targeted him. He was married for, you know, about 15 to 20 years. He had three children, and I'm not sure if I'm, that's unconfirmed. I don't know how many children he had, but from what I know, he had three. And they took his children, and just to kind of give you an idea of what the mentality is here, is they placed his children in a foster care home directly across the street from him.
Right.
And
psychological,
can you imagine,
torture.
Yeah, exactly. Can you imagine, like, what it did to those children, what it did to, you know, the parents? And unfortunately, his wife, you know, couldn't take it, mm-hmm. and she committed suicide. You know, and
When was that incident?
I believe, if you give me a few seconds, I can actually research it really quickly.
Okay.
It was just a couple years ago.
The main point is that, like, you know, he was obviously saying things that he, not only they didn't like, but he was exposing something, obviously, wasn't he?
He was exposing something, and he was very vocal about it, and they just sort of, you know, he may not have had a perfect past because he did do time in jail, but this is years before. You know, if you do any time in jail, it just stays with you for the rest of your life. And, you know, you're supposed to, you've paid your debt to society, you're now back on the street, and you're trying to help, you know, get yourself off your feet. And, you know, they tried to do this with their own family, and unfortunately, his wife hung himself in the house, and he was the one that had to take her down. And, you know, I don't think he had a lot of support. There wasn't a lot for him.
Ryan, let me just ask if you have any questions or comments.
Yeah, I do. I was about to jump in there, and I just wanted to ask. I know here in the United States, the CPS, there's a lot of drugging of children once they're taken from the home. Is that something also the CFS does? They put these kids on a lot of different psychotropic drugs?
They do. They do, actually. I have another case here. He's a gentleman now. He's 35 years old, and he told me his story. He was in CFS care at the age of three. And during all that time that he was in foster care, he was molested, he was raped, he was drugged. And by the time he turned 18, you know, even if the children complain, it is silenced. They will not. And if they try to talk to a family member, because these poor kids are just, somebody listen to them and nobody will. And if the family tries to bring up the complaint of the child, then you become a criminal and you're no longer allowed to talk to these children.
Now, was the abuse at the hands of the CFS workers, or was this at the hands of, let's say, the foster family?
It's both. It's everything. It's the social workers, it's the youth care workers, the hospital staff, you name it. They're everywhere. Go ahead.
Have you seen many CFS workers quit their jobs to try to expose this because they've seen what's happened?
There was one lady, I don't have her name at the top of my head, but she actually did a show with Charles Adler. And I did listen to the show, but I didn't really appreciate what was being said. It was like they were just trying to downplay all the evil and the torment and the whatnot that was going on. She spoke mostly of her bonding with the children that she was trying to protect. And so we're sort of dealing with the stuff that most people don't want to hear. If it's out of sight, it's out of mind. And my goal is to get it out there, keep talking about it, encourage people, empower people, because the majority of these people I've talked to, they all have this one thing in common, and it's CFS. These social workers are former prostitutes. They are drug addicts themselves.
Right.
They're alcoholics.
Well, that's the pattern. It's like with the chiefs at the Assembly of First Nations. All of them have criminal pasts. They're either drug addicts or have molested children. That way the government can control them. And it's the same in a criminal body. You'll find the employees have that controllability, right? If you look into the history of the CFS, and let me just insert this now, something Ryan asked earlier. The CFS was actually formed in the year 2000, but it was formed specifically aimed at Aboriginal families. It says that in the mandate. And that came out of something in 1988 called the Aboriginal Justice Inquiry, started by the Manitoba government, that was chaired, one of the co-chairs was Murray Sinclair, who just did the enormous whitewash called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, covering up genocide in the residential schools. This Murray Sinclair, who was at the time chief judge of the provincial court in Manitoba, helped write this report. And basically what it did is it did the same thing that what happened in British Columbia, which also has a very high Aboriginal population. It said, under the guise of returning control of Native families to Native communities, which sounds great, right? In fact, what it did is it found a way to cut more and more families off welfare under the guise of, well, you're in the hands of your own people now. They can decide what to do. And the chiefs on the reservations, where a lot of these people end up, have an agreement with the government. They have a quota of the number of people they're going to cut off the rolls every year. We've got the minutes from the Assembly of First Nations meetings in Ottawa planning this. It's called Agenda 21. It came out of the United Nations over 20 years ago, a plan to depopulate Indigenous populations around the world. And the way they do this is under the guise, they use code words. Like, you know, when genocide in Canada was called assimilation, that was our code word for it, which was outright extermination. The code word for this Agenda 21 is sustainable development. Well, if a group isn't sustainable, it means there's too many mouths to feed, so you get rid of them. And this is the whole plan. So the attacks you're seeing, Debbie, on these families, it was aimed specifically at how to destroy Native families and eventually eliminate them. It's like point two in the Genocide Convention. You create the conditions where they're going to die over the long term. That's exactly what's going on now in Native communities in Canada, especially in places like Winnipeg.
That's right. The agenda. Go ahead.
I was just going to say in regards to the families, this is what they're doing is they're forcing them into worse than poverty lifestyles. And not only that, what they do is they make life very difficult for people who are on social assistance. Mm-hmm. They make them go all over the city to go pick up bus passes or bus tickets. They just make things very difficult. But, you know, the one thing that is very easily to find are doctors in their clinics, and they are writing out prescription drugs like you wouldn't believe.
Yeah.
And these people are becoming addicted to these pills. They're desensitizing people.
Yeah.
And, this is the addictions that are happening, and they're feeding them this, and it all ties in together to just take your life away. And they don't have freedom. There's nothing for them to do. They have all these things going on in the city, but never do they do it in the poverty-stricken areas. They're closing pools and community centers, and families can't even take them there, but they'll make sure that they have all the bars and the alcohol open till 4 o'clock just because FIFA was here.
Yeah. Ryan, go ahead.
I was just going to agree with you, Kevin, and say, yeah, Agenda 21, it came out of the Sustainable Development Movement, and it was actually signed at the 1992 Earth Summit, part of the United Nations, and part of the plan calls for a confiscation of land under what has kind of become known as the Green Movement. In order to protect the environment, the government needs to come in and take Native land. And out of that, actually, in the United Nations Security Council, in I think it was 1974, they produced another document called the National Security Memorandum 200, Implications of Worldwide Population Growth. And this was strictly for the United States, but a lot of other countries follow this same policy, like London or like Britain, for example. And the plan basically calls for different forms of modified manufactured warfare, manufactured famines, and threats to the nation that are manufactured in order to create this fear and to coerce different nations that oppose these bigger nations like Britain or the United States in order to keeping their population in check under the guise of you're not going to get any types of financial aid if you do not do this. So that's that's a direct plan from the United Nations.
Here's another aspect of it. You know, we've talked about sterilization programs, and we find this all over still. Often in Vancouver, I'd meet Native women who said, yeah, family services said I couldn't see my children again unless I agreed to have a tubal ligation and stop having children. That's common. Here's an interview with Robert McNamara. Remember, he was the architect of the Vietnam War under Kennedy, and he headed the World Bank. And in 1996, he headed something connected to Agenda 21 called the Expanded Immunization Program. He said, and here's a direct quote, an interview with the Paris magazine J'ai Tout Compris in August 1996, quote, "One must take draconian measures of demographic reduction against the will of certain populations. Reducing the birth rate has proved to be impossible or insufficient. One must therefore increase the mortality rate. How? By natural means, famine and sickness," unquote. So these are out-and-out genocidal plans, and in a place like Winnipeg, the way it manifests is exactly the way that Debbie is describing. You criminalize populations, not just the natives, but any poor person, and you put them in a state of warfare. And the fact that the government is behind this is proof in the fact that the cops don't need warrants. Because if you're a cop, you're not going to break the law unless you know your back is covered. So when you see that thing going on, you know it's like in the residential schools, when the people would beat the kids to death, they knew they were being covered. They'd be protected and it would be covered up. So this is part of a big octopus system that we're seeing, you know, along the lines of what Debbie's describing.
Oh, yeah, and actually what she said about, you know, keeping bars open to 4 o'clock in the morning, making sure that that takes place. You see lots of drugs, lots of alcohol, all of that being pumped into different communities that are native and minority groups throughout the world. And that's another way to keep these people suppressed and keep the system in a perpetual state of division.
Yes, and that's what they're trying to do. They're pitting people against, they're pitting the working class against the poor and blaming the poor. It's all their fault. And, you know, it's we've got to get our listeners and our people to wake up and realize that they're trying to create us arguing and fighting. And they're doing this and they're succeeding in families. A person that's on social assistance, a pregnant mother or a mother with children, she's not allowed to have a boyfriend live with her if she's on welfare. And if she does have a boyfriend or a father to her children, he then becomes a criminal, and you know, it's just, it's a horrible thing. And if then they get into an argument, then the court now becomes involved. Welfare will tell you, you need to divorce that man, you need to get rid of that man in order for us to give you money. So they're really not in it for families. They're just slowly taking either your children or your money or your dignity, everything away. They're stripping them, and they don't even realize it.
They're breaking the family apart on purpose. Both the child and the mother become wards of the state, and the father becomes this criminalized figure. Absolutely. That's happening all over the world. And as a matter of fact, what you mentioned about vaccinations, Kevin, you know, you go back into like 1907, I think it was 1907 in the United States, they had these vaccination programs. But in 1933, there was the Sterilization Act passed in Germany. And the Sterilization Act, along with the T4 vaccination programs, they were really handed out under the guise of protecting people and giving out a type of free health care, just like the Tuskegee experiment in Alabama in 1933, where these black men had been given syphilis on purpose under the guise of being given free health care because they were poor and from the inner cities. And these vaccination programs are targeted specifically towards people who have lower IQs, specifically to or people that are considered to be political dissidents, or people, for example, like us who speak out against what's happening. We're considered mentally ill, and therefore we fall under the guidelines of becoming vaccinated, which all these vaccinations do is cause sterility and an assortment of other neurological disorders. It's all part of a much deeper underlying plan.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that date, 1933, because that's exactly the same year that the Sterilization Act was passed in British Columbia, and Alberta beat them out. In 1929, the sterilization laws in Alberta were very broad, even broader than the ones in America, in Germany. Under the Alberta sterilization laws, if you were Aboriginal or Métis, if you were mentally deficient, and of course Indians were considered mentally deficient by nature, they were on a lower mental category, and any Indian could on that basis be sterilized. If you were, you know, there was a long list of what justified sterilization of anyone when they reached puberty. If you were an immoral girl who had a child out of wedlock, boom, sterilized. I worked with a woman for a while. Her name was Pat Taylor. She was a nurse at what's called the Provincial Training School in Red Deer, Alberta. At the Panoka Metal Institute in Alberta, they were carting in young girls there, left, right, and center. Any young Native girl found walking on the street, they were just bringing them and sterilizing them en masse. This was in the 1950s and 60s. And, you know, there were even lawsuits about that and everything. So this is a worldwide phenomena. And anyway, it keeps manifesting all the time.
terrible.
Yeah, yeah. You know, if you dig deep, it's kind of like any rot. Go ahead.
There's still Aboriginals living on the reserves that don't have running water in their home. You know,
about half of the reserves. Half of the reserves in Manitoba don't have clean water. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. It's a really sad situation, and it's a big battle. But I think that we can definitely do this, Kevin, with all the organizations connecting them. And there's people out there that think that they can't give to the community, or they don't know how to. And it's all about motivation and empowering other people. Each person has a different interest, and they should take that idea and run with it. And eventually, we are all going to be connected and united. It's just going to take time, and we've got a fight on our hands.
Well, I wanted to talk about that in the second half of the show, which we're in. Now, one of the things that, you know, we've got so many people working on all these different issues. One of the projects that people are working on back east, and we want to spread this all over the country, is they're gathering people together in what they're calling people's assemblies, where these are weekly gatherings where anyone in the community can bring in an issue and people debate it and then say, okay, what are we going to do about it as a community? And these things are beginning to take off. I mean, one of the things which are really interesting is in southern Ontario, and I don't want to mention all these towns yet, but this one group that's setting up a people's assembly is actually going to the mayor of the town and saying, look, why are you sending all our tax money to Ottawa? You know what they're using the tax money for? It's to pay off the banks and the interest rates. We need to keep that money in our community. So the town mayor and council are looking seriously at saying, okay, the revenue stays in our community. And that's just one way of uniting people and saying, look, we've got to find a forum in which we can bring all these things together. It's no good people fighting on their own. You see what happens. You know, you're picked off and isolated, and we have to start bringing this together. So this is one of the things we want to do in Winnipeg in the fall. We're going to start holding these assemblies and getting the issue of child trafficking front and center in Winnipeg especially. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about that, Debbie, about, you know, your ideas about that and what, you know, some advice you have for people who are in that situation and seem to be struggling alone. I know how despairing it can be.
Yes, I agree with that, Kevin, and definitely all ideas matter. Everybody's opinion matters, and once we get everybody united together, we will become stronger, and we will have to deal with the government because they don't want to talk to us. They, for instance, if you take a look at our premier, Greg Selinger, everybody has gone over these shadow groups because they're there, they're being paid with our tax dollars, but they really don't do anything for you.
No.
And in one case, there was a photo of one of the children that were apprehended that went all over social media, and it was inappropriate. And this child is in foster care. When the family member brought that to the attention of CFS, they denied it. They said, that's it, you're not talking with the family anymore, you're trouble. And so that person went to the Children's Advocacy. They closed down the investigation, and I seen this with my own eyes in an email that they confirmed that they did the investigation without ever talking to the child.
Well, this is what we're talking about. You see, the system is so rife with corruption and unaccountability that people get burned out very easily with their energy trying to take on this because
Absolutely.
It's like chasing your tail. And we've
got
there's a bottom line here. We have to protect people, and the police aren't doing it. And if the police aren't going to do it, then we've got to do it. And this is why part of this whole People's Assembly idea is we got to start training the people in the community to, you know, when the cops come in, to stand there and stop them from taking these children away. You know, and
that's right. And you know, yes, that's very good advice, Kevin. And just, you know, if we have our listeners that are affected by that, if CFS comes to your door, do not answer the door. If they have a concern about your children, you show them to them through the window. Don't ever open that door, because the moment you open that door, you're losing your rights. And the Constitution is right out the window. Don't ever let them in. And, you know, they are a power group, and they have their thugs, which is the Winnipeg Police. So they have the manpower. They've got the money. And look at what these people have in the North End. They've got nothing.
You know, the thing about police agencies these days is they're all private companies for hire. I noticed this when
right,
I was in New York.
Rent-a-cops.
Yeah, I was in New York and in Barnes & Noble bookstore. There's two New York cops standing there. And I said, what are you guys doing here? And they said, oh, we work for Barnes & Noble. And so you're hired by a bookstore to be your private security. I mean, that's the way the system's gone. So don't expect these cops to have to use warrants. They're a corporate employee. And that's why we need our own community police force.
That's right.
Sorry, Ryan, I think you were trying to say something.
No, it's okay. I definitely have seen an increase in that as well. As a matter of fact, I've seen some of the big biotech companies, the international companies that have patented a lot of seeds for food, part of Agenda 21 as well, and Codex Alimentarius. One company called Monsanto actually hired Blackwater, the security force that was right. slaughtering kids in Afghanistan and Iraq, even up until today. They hired them as their private security force to protect right. their crops against people who were protesting them.
Right. It's the same all over the world. There's a simple problem we all face is that when you know you're up against this horrible, unaccountable corporate system and you feel like you're all alone, you just fold. You get drained really quickly, and that's what they want.
Yeah, and you fall into all these different... Go ahead.
Yeah, and to think about it, just to give an idea, a lot of these people are tied up in the court systems, and it's not just through CFS, but it's silly little charges for failing to appear in court. Or some people actually speak in court, and the judges are shushing them and telling them to be quiet. And they're not really getting out what they want because they don't understand the law. The majority of the people don't understand the law, and they can't afford to hire a lawyer. And there's a fellow who spent $100,000 in lawyer's fees. He did get his children back. But can you imagine what $100,000 could do for a family? And it's all sitting in a lawyer's pocket right now.
Yeah. Well, it's all fraud.
You just took from those children.
Here's a little bit of information. And power is knowledge, people. In Canada, there's the only thing we have in the way of a constitution guaranteeing a Bill of Rights. It's called the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. It's an act of parliament, which means it can be revoked at any time. By the Crown, by the Governor General, one guy in Ottawa can revoke all of your rights legally. But even within the Charter of Rights, there's this thing called a notwithstanding clause where it says you're granted four fundamental freedoms we're giving to you, except under the following circumstances. And they have a whole list of things, acts of war, acts of emergency, public safety, medical emergency. So suddenly there's a plague, there's a virus somewhere. Sorry, you don't have any rights anymore. And so, all of this is a way to make people think, oh, we've got rights, but in fact, you don't have rights in Canada under this system. There's no unalienable liberties under the Canadian law, and this is why we have to create it from the ground up. And so we say to people, stay the hell out of the courts, stay out of the system. We've got to build it from the ground up.
Well, how do we start some of these people's assemblies?
Oh, well, we're actually putting out something on CanadaRepublic.ca and ITCCS.org very soon about this. There's a little handbook they're doing up. You basically get 12 people together. It's like a jury. You convene 12 people, and you say, we want to start having these assemblies. We're going to form, call it a citizen's militia, whatever, a security force to protect us. And we need common law courts to basically bring in the laws that we want to see in our community and enact those laws. That's how you build a nation from the ground up. And it's, in the case of what you're struggling with there, Debbie, you multiply that 1,000 times across the country. And that's what people, honest people, are facing. We've got to give them an alternative now. We can't allow them to kind of piss away their lives in the system anymore. So anyway, that's going to be up very soon.
There's no hope for a lot of these people. And you're forced into giving up. So it's a really sad, vicious cycle that these people are being put in. And I will not stop until, I die. Like, they can keep killing advocates and, pushing them and forcing them into suicide, but we're always going to pop up. Like, we're always going to be there. So for anyone that goes down, there's two more that are going to be up. And I will make sure that I make that happen for my city, because I want to take my city back.
Yes, exactly. Perfectly said. You know, there. I want to interject a funny little news item here, and I just to kind of change the pace a little bit, but I think you'll find this amusing. There's a guy, I don't know if you remember him, he was the president of France. His name was Sarkozy, Nicolas Sarkozy. He was married to this glamorous Hollywood person. And you probably don't remember this, but he was defeated in the last election. News in the London Telegraph today, former president of France, formally charged for a kickback scandal. It turns out that Nicolas Sarkozy accepted 50 million euros in an illegal campaign financing from the former Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi. And what's interesting about this article, the very same day I saw this article on Gaddafi, I said, wait a minute, this rings a bell. And I went through my back files. Gaddafi had another very good friend in Europe called Cardinal Sergio Pignadoli. Now, this cardinal died conveniently in 1980. He was one of the inside group in the Vatican. Remember the pope they poisoned back in 1978? Because he began to investigate the Vatican Bank, Pope John Paul I. Well, Pignadoli was one of his friends, and he was friends with the present Pope Francis, Jorge Bergoglio. Well, Pignadoli was advocating an alliance between the Vatican and Arab money and the Arab world, and he got his wrist slapped because he was getting too close to the Arabs. But Pignadoli was a recipient of Gaddafi money as well. And it kind of shows you this interesting triangle you find all the time between this corporate church state sector. It keeps rearing its head. And I think it's especially relevant that this people are reminded about this kind of thing because Pope Francis, Jorge Bergoglio, you know, a convicted child trafficker, is coming to the United States in September. He's going to speak at the General Assembly and then to both houses of Congress. And the question is, why is he coming to this time? What's interesting is that the scuttlebutt that I get out of people in Europe is that there's a lot of Chinese money going in to buy up the Vatican debt, just like the Chinese have bought up about half the American debt. So, I mean, China is, you know, here's one scenario. China is taking over the United States and the Vatican both. And I think Bergoglio is going to Washington to help seal the deal. I mean, I know that's speculation and everything, but it whether we're talking about these crimes in Winnipeg or around the world, it's the same criminals that you keep running into all the time, and it's the same institutions. So I thought I'd throw that out there for a bit of levity, but also some interesting insights.
Yeah, they keep popping their head up everywhere, don't they? And it all ties into this intricate web, corporately, socially, politically, religiously. It's all just a giant, giant scam. And something going back to what we talked about at the beginning of the show, you mentioned, let's say, the Indian Act, and we mentioned the Agenda 21, what they call the environmental sustainability. You know, it's always that play on words, that differentiation of languages that they use in order to make it sound like this is something that people need. We need the Indian Act. It sounds like it must be good for Indians. Yeah. We need the Sterilization Act because it's going to help sterilize people who don't need to have kids, when in reality it has nothing to do with that. It has to do with sterilizing anybody who is an offense to the state, anybody who is a threat. It's always just a play on words. It's just a big scam, and it's really even for people like us, for people like me, it becomes really frustrating. So I know for other people out there who don't know as much about this, it has to be really irritating, and that's why I think a lot of people get burnt out so fast. It's because even when they start to kind of see through the veil, you know, the words and the terms that are used make it seem, you know, like we're still just insane and we're still crazy. Right. You know, the government wouldn't do that. They, you know, the name of the act is Protect Children Act, the Child Protective Services. They wouldn't hurt children.
Well, the Hitler's
laws. Oh, I have to agree with you on that.
Yeah.
They are trying desperately, and I just came into light of this in the last couple of weeks. Because it does take critical thinking, and what I noticed is a lot of the government is trying to force you onto disability, and I think it ties into what you were saying, Kevin, is once they get you on disability, then you sort of lose all your rights because the government now owns you. The state owns you.
Yeah. It's like on the Indian Act, you cannot refuse medical treatment if you're living on reservation. So if they want to drag your kid away and poke something in their arm, you can't refuse or you go to jail.
It's yeah, like as a matter of
right.
Yeah, they're like making the whole country an Indian reservation.
That's right, yes. And I think that's how they're, in a way, pitting any other race against the Aboriginals. And I think there's a lot of misunderstanding, a lot of lies that are being told, and you know, like I said, they pick on the poor, trying to make Aboriginals look like they're drunkards, but yet you see a lot of white people doing the same thing on Cordon Avenue. So why is it okay that they do it, and it's not okay for the Aboriginals?
Hey, I used to hang out on Cordon Avenue. Uh-oh, busted! No, I'm just going to say that Hitler's laws, you know, when he created the concentration camps, were actually the first inmates were political prisoners. They weren't Jews at all till years later, but they were political prisoners and primarily.
People that were mentally ill. The Jews and actually blacks, homosexuals, Jews, gypsies, they didn't come till much later, actually.
Yeah, but these laws were called protective confinement laws. They were putting people in the concentration camps for their own safety. That was the official rationale, and most Germans believe them. So, anyway, we've got go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to tie that together again with what we've been talking about the whole show. And, you know, those concentration camps were actually purchased, specifically the Auschwitz, which was a series of concentration camps, not just one. It was purchased by IG Farben, which was the chemical company that Hitler had a lot of stock in, as well as Merck and some other vaccination companies and chemical companies.
Yep.
And there's actually an IG Farben branch in the United States. And it's a matter of fact that the Bush family, presidential family here in the U.S., royal blue bloods, directly connected and related to the royal crown and Queen Elizabeth very, very closely, not even distant, very close. And that family there in particular met with people from some of the SS soldiers who had run some of these programs, and they run, I think it was called the, I can't remember the name of the Institute for Racial Hygiene.
That continued after the war. Well, that continued before and after the war. There were strong ties across the Atlantic. The eugenics movement began in America, the Rockefeller Foundation. That's a whole other show.
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
I do want to flag a book for people you can read about that called War Against the Weak, America's Plan to Create a Master Race by Edwin Black. And it goes into all the sterilization laws, the origin of the eugenics movement in America and Nazi Germany, the ties between the Rockefeller interests, and how they're tied into today to Big Pharma and who are funding Hillary Clinton's campaign and, you know, the whole bit. So that's a whole topic. We got about 6 minutes left, and I wanted to ask Debbie if you have other things you want to say. And I know we're going to carry this on, but I'm going to give you the floor as well right now.
Well, I think I'm, you know, it's a very hard job to do, Kevin, without being emotionally affected. So, you know, I'm human like everybody else, and it's draining to do that. But if I can stress to your listeners that compassion really does go a long way. And it's, you know, you want to do that not to get anything in return, but to at least see better. You know, our kids are not being educated properly, especially the ones that are in foster care. They're being bounced around. There's no stability. There's no faith in them. So, you know, I'm a little, you know, frustrated, but I'm not going to give up, and I don't want anybody else to give up.
Well, we won't. And we're, as a matter of fact, this is a commitment. There is other people in Winnipeg. We're going to be uniting in the fall. In September, we're going to be opening people's assemblies in a number of different places across Canada, but especially in Winnipeg, which is a hotspot of all this stuff. If people want to be part of that, you can write to republicofcanada@gmail.com, canatarepublic.ca. Join the movement now and unite these different issues around this three common points. Defend our children, defend our land, defend our liberties. And we have to unite everybody around those three. And that's the purpose of the Republic and our common law movement. So, Debbie, I just want to, you know, thank you again for your courage. And we're going to be talking again offline about, you know, more of the nuts and bolts about all this. But, you know, I want to invite you back again in the future with more updates. I know you've got, you know, other stories you want to share. And in the hour we're given, we often don't have a lot of time. But I want to, you know, invite you back and others who you think would be good for us to hear from.
Yes, I would love to be back, Kevin, and I will keep in touch.
Thank you, Debbie. We'll talk
to you
soon.
Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
And Ryan, I want to just, again, especially flag, you know, when we're talking about this educational component on the show, I think it's time for us to bring in a more organized way some of kind of the history and background for a lot of these issues. So we'll be talking about that more in the future.
Sounds wonderful. That's exactly what we need, is a lot more education, get people to understand where we're coming from and why we're doing what we're doing, so we don't just seem like we're some fringe group. It's very important to have education of the past so we can understand what's going on in the present.
Right now, any final thoughts or words? I'm going to just mention again to people itccs.org and canadarepublic.ca. You might want to see itccs.org, the latest posting. I think it's kind of humorous. But we've got to keep our levity and keeps our spirits up, people. But any final words, Ryan?
No, I don't think so for today. Anything else I think might take us a little bit over the allotted time,
okay.
Mark.
All right. Fair enough.
Glad to be back. And I think having Debbie on today was a really good guest, and look forward to speaking with her in the future. And with you as well, Kevin, we'll talk to you next week.
Yes, and we'll have an announcement next week about actually a talk I'm giving in New York City on July 17th, Friday. I'll remind you again this next week about it, but I'm speaking with Colley Clark, who's a very famous civil rights activist. We're going to be speaking Friday, July 17th at between 5 and 8 p.m. at 330 7th Avenue. That's the National Opera House. Ooh, sounds impressive, eh? 330 7th Avenue, right off near Penn Station in New York, July 17th, 5 p.m. Be there, and we'll carry this on. But we'll have you back next week, same time, same place, Radio Free Canada. Until then, stay strong and clear.